Well, welcome to this episode of Kennedy's Medical Law Matters podcast, where we dive into some of the most important conversations around healthcare and medical law. I'm Rob Tobin. I'm a partner here at Kennedy's and head of the Medical Law Group. Today, we're going to be talking about a very sensitive topic, assisted dying. So discretion is advised as to whether or not you feel comfortable listening. Please do remember to subscribe or follow this podcast on any of the usual podcast platforms that you use, and we do hope to hear back from you with any comments and feedback. So the fundamental principle behind the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, which is a bit of a mouthful in itself, is rooted in the concept of autonomy, that a capacitous person should have the right to choose what happens to their body and when. And this is a theme that has been running through medical law quite a number of times over the recent, say, 10, 20 years, move away from the paternalistic medicine approach with, you know, Montgomery on consent, Tracy on DNA CPRs, Cheshire West on deprivation of liberty. And today we're going to be talking about the, let's call it the assisted dying bill. I'm delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague, Dan Freeman, fellow partner at Kennedy's in the Medical Law Group. Dan, perhaps you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me. As Rob said, my name's Dan Freeman. I've been a partner, well, I am a partner at Kennedy's. I've been at Kennedy's for 15 years and like Rob, specialise in healthcare law, capacity, consent, claims and inquests. And just really glad to be here joining you on this very sensitive topic.
Thanks, Dan. It's good to have you. So we're going to be discussing the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill or Assisted Dying Bill, particularly looking at some of the practicalities and impracticalities and how they might impact the medical and legal systems. The topic is hugely emotive, like many of our topics, and we, of course, recognize that there are many different opinions out there on all sides of the debate, and I'm deliberately saying all sides rather than both sides because I don't think it is a just partisan debate. Some of those will no doubt come up today, and I apologize in advance if we don't represent or articulate all of the views in this space. The law as it stands in the UK, so before this bill is formally enacted, is that it's illegal to aid, abet, counsel, or procure the suicide of another person. And that comes from the 1961 Suicide Act. There have been a number of calls over the years to change that, sometimes simply to further the principle of autonomy, and usually for more specific reasons around autonomy and self-determination for those people who are in the throes of a terminal illness, for whom their life will inevitably end soon. Likely with physical, emotional, and psychological pain and suffering, despite the best supportive care the palliative care community can provide. So, Dan, do you want to give us an introduction of what the bill hopes to change from that current position?
So thanks, Rob. Yes, so going into the background about the bill and giving a bit of a summary, it was revitalised by Lord Falconer following originally being raised by Baroness Meacher in 2021 and retabled by Kim Ledbetter MP more recently. It's now currently at its committee stage. The key criteria for it to be, for a patient to be eligible, which is the words used in the bill at the moment, is that you do need the consent of a judicial panel. You need the formal and voluntary clear declaration, which is settled and informed wish to end a person's life. That declaration needs to be witnessed. It needs to be approved by two clinicians and a further independent clinician. The patient must be 18 or over. They must have capacity to end their own life, and they must be ordinarily resident in England and Wales for a year or more, which I think is there to prevent a form of health tourism. And then the ultimate key bit, and I think this is the most mouthful part of it, is that the patient must have an inevitably progressive condition which cannot be reversed by treatment, which is described as the terminal illness and cannot reasonably be expected to die within 6 months. And from that as well, any treatment or any reduction in symptoms would not be considered to be a cure for that illness.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, just if you don't mind, because there's a lot of detail, isn't there? So hang on, let's break it down. So we've got a situation where someone, first of all, they have to have a terminal illness with less than 6 months to live, which of course is a very, very subjective test that a doctor will do their best to establish and declare, and that's quite an important thing, isn't it? That doctor has to be seconded that there has to be another doctor who's agreed with that doctor. And the person that you said has to have capacity. I know we'll talk about this in a bit, I'm sure, but you know, they have to not been unduly influenced and forced in or coerced in any way into the decision. And then you mentioned the High Court judge or judiciary. And then, as you say, there's a whole process around the administration of the medication itself. Let's talk about, I don't know, where do we start? Should we talk about capacity actually now, just because it's quite a topical issue? So what do you think is the determining reason why that's in there, that capacity question point?
Capacity is always a grey area, isn't it? Especially in our world. And because capacity is decision-based, so it'd have to be capacity over this decision. Just because someone may not have capacity over other elements of their decision-making, they have to have capacity over this. But I think the capacity element is to fully ensure that that person is making the decision for themselves and they're not influenced by some mental illness or some, as the Mental Capacity Act sets out, some illness or difficulty of the mind or brain. And it's there really to make sure that that person is making that decision on their own, of their own free will. And I think, like you said, with the clinicians, it cannot be under duress as well, because any capacity or consent given under duress is never correct. And so really it's to ensure that that person is making that very personal decision to them, and that there can be no real query as to whether that decision was correct or whether it was affected by anything else.
Yeah. I mean, one of my challenges with the drafters of the bill, and we did put this, Kennedy's made some submissions to the committee, or suggestions to the committee. There's reference to the Mental Capacity Act, as you say, and the fact that a person needs to have capacity to make this decision, which is obviously must be right. But there's also requirements, as I understand it, for the doctors to test that capacity. You know, do the capacity test, as you know, as you say, to confirm that they haven't got a disorder of the mind or brain that renders them incapable of making a decision, and they understand, they can use, retain, weigh, and communicate that decision back. And the decision here is obviously that they want to die and be assisted to die. But the Mental Capacity Act has a presumption of capacity, i.e. it's presumed that someone has capacity unless otherwise established. It seems to me that this, the way it's drafted at the moment, at least, is reversing that presumption. And it's presuming, unless you can establish they have capacity, they don't have capacity. I can understand why that additional safeguard is in there, but some people might be troubled by that, I suppose, would be my point.
Yeah, I can see why. But I think, and I was having a discussion this week about, I suppose it's to ensure that there are a set of checks and balances in place to fully ensure that that person does have capacity, purely because of the finality of the event. And you're right, it does reverse the presumption of capacity, and almost. So I think it is just those checks and balances, purely because of the sheer finality of it, and also the risks for everybody else involved, I suppose, because it's not necessarily just, of course, the vast majority is about the person that's involved, but there's a lot of moving parts that would need to be involved as well, whether it be the assessing clinician, the not administering clinician, the assisting clinician, if I can put it that way, to ensure that there can be no qualms or queries over a person's capacity. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, and let's look at those checks and balances, because there are lots and lots of safeguards in this bill. And certainly if you look at, and we perhaps talk about it, we look at some of the other jurisdictions in the world where they have a form of assisted dying act, they don't necessarily have as many checks and balances. And I suppose one of the challenges that the House of Commons and Lords will have here in drafting the final legislation is getting that balance right between ensuring there are sufficient safeguards in place to prevent, say, someone who isn't of sound mind, or perhaps they are, but they feel they're being coerced into making a decision, which in hindsight is not their fully formed independent decision, against the other side of things, which is causing such an onerous process that creates massive work for doctors and massive pressure and potentially moral injury to doctors who are having to do a lot of the legwork in drafting or writing that declaration and signing it off. Plus the judges, and let's talk about that now, the judges or this panel who will have to make that decision and endorse it And then after the judges, it goes back to the doctors to do a second declaration to check that nothing's changed. So one of the things that we suggested to the committee is changed, and I'm not going to pretend that they did change this because of us, because I think lots of people were asking this as well, is the pressure on the judiciary. And the original bill, as you say, had this process whereby the declaration that had been endorsed, signed by, or countersigned, I suppose, by the doctors, then went to a High Court judge who was required to take some evidence from the doctor and anyone else they think is appropriate and effectively endorse that declaration. There was a big concern amongst the judiciary that that would just be an onerous, unbelievable amount of work for the already overworked judiciary. I think estimates ranged from like 12,000 to 15, 20,000 hours of extra judicial time a year, just because of the number of, I think it was suggested that about 1 to 3% of people who die would go through this process, and extrapolating that back, it was a few thousand people, and then you times that by, say, 2 to 3 hours of judicial time for each case. And it was just felt too onerous. So what they've suggested now in the current form of the bill is a separate panel. So there's going to be the Voluntary Assisted Dying Commissioner, and I think the voluntary is not relating to the commissioner, it's relating to the assisted dying, whose role, and that person is going to be, would have to have held the office of a Supreme Court judge, Court of Appeal judge, or High Court judge. So a very senior legal person. And then there'll be a deputy commissioner as well. And then they are supported by a panel, or will be supported by a panel, which is, I suppose, a judicial panel, probably a bit like another tribunal might be, sort of made up of, again, it's probably going to be someone equivalent to a High Court judge, possibly a KC, plus a psychiatrist and a social worker. And I'm quite intrigued by the choice of those disciplines. It suggests that it's all about, the real focus on the safeguarding is about the person's mind and state of mind, rather than their terminal illness. Because, for example, why isn't an oncologist on that panel or someone else? But I'm not saying they should be, but it's just interesting that's the area they're going towards. And that panel will sit and hear all these cases, and they will gather evidence, and they'll hear from doctors, patients. They may even hear from family members. It's up to them, I suppose, and the makeup of those. But that's a big safeguard. What do you think? I mean, do you think it will work? Do you think it's too onerous? Will it take too long?
Rob, I think it is going to be a huge amount of work, purely because I think there are so many stages. There are so many checks and balances that we have to have in place that I think we've already discussed. But there has to be that initial discussion with clinicians, and for want of a better word, and using the wording in the legislation, a clinician has to consider if somebody is, in inverted commas, eligible for this and to fulfill that criteria. Then they have to obviously make sure they're 18 plus, which hopefully won't be an issue, but that may become an issue at some point. But then there has to be this definition of the inevitably progressive illness, disease, and medical condition that cannot be reversed by treatment, where the terminal event is likely to happen in the next 6 months. There may be discussion over that. There may be queries. There may be MDTs. So already we're eating into this 6 months. Then there's initial discussions with the clinicians about all of that. Then there's a first declaration from the patient, which has to be double checked. Then there's an assessment by a first doctor, then an assessment by a second doctor. And I wonder, and I know you've read the same article, Rob, and the same research about Australia, but in Australia and in Victoria, there has to be a mandatory gap between that discussion between the first doctor and the second doctor to allow for multiple opportunities for that person to ensure they are making this decision on their own. Then there's a requirement as well to explain all the other treatments available, whether that be palliative, whether that be hospice care. Then there's a second opinion of the independent clinician. Then it goes back to the judicial panel that you've discussed already, which is an awful lot of work, an awful lot of time that will have to go into this. And I wonder if, and going back to you, Rob, whether that, for those, say, week-long periods between, to allow for like a consenting procedure, if I can put it like that, would eat into that, and what your thoughts on the amount of work will be.
Yeah, and it's, again, it goes back to that balance, doesn't it? Because I do endorse the need, and there is discussion about it in this bill of, you know, having some time to reflect for concern for the patient themselves and the clinician who's looking at it, and if the patient wishes, there for their family as well to be involved. But as you say, the purpose of this whole bill is to enable that person, the patient, to have autonomy, and ultimately to, you'd assume, to alleviate, reduce at least the significant likely suffering that they will endure towards the end of their life, despite all the best endeavors with, you know, best supportive care, palliative care, etc., etc. So there's a really fine balance, and I think the bill does really well to cover a lot of these things. But I do have that concern, and talking about the doctors, the role of the doctors in this scenario is quite interesting, because, you know, you mentioned all the work they need to do, and some of it's almost sort of quasi legal work. You know, it's not just yes, there's the medical aspect. You know, the doctor has to confirm that the patient has that terminal illness of 6 months or less, which I know is very subjective, but they can use their experience on that. But then there's all of the work around the coercion. You know, have they been coerced? Well, I mean, they can ask that question, but how much are they required to test that evidence? You know, if it was us, if we were looking at this from a legal case perspective, we would be, you know, interviewing witnesses, we'd be asking the family members, we'd be asking people who know the patient, we'd obviously be speaking to the patient themselves to really drill down into what's going on in their lives. But a lot of these doctors will have only met these patients a few times. They might be their GP, in which case they might know them better. I mean, I don't know my GP that well. Or they might be someone who's only just met the patient. So there's quite a lot of onus on that medic to look into this. And again, because there isn't this presumption, to look into and establish that the declaration that the patient wants to make is the correct one. I mean, there are, you know, I should say that this is all because of these criteria around the terminal illness and the lack of coercion. There are people out there who don't think this bill's gone far enough. You know, the fact that it's called the Terminally Ill Adults Bill is very, I'm sure it's very deliberate, because they want to exclude those other people who might want to fall into these criteria, say with neurodegenerative conditions like Parkinson's disease, some aspects of motor neuron disease, and other conditions that might contain or might result in quite unbearable suffering for a person, but not necessarily with that 6 months life expectancy or less. And so I can see the challenges the drafters of the bill have had, and not least because we know that, as you say, Lord Faulkner's attempt not that long ago didn't succeed at the Lords stage because there weren't enough safeguards in place. But I do worry that there are too many, and as you say, the onus is on the clinicians and then the judges to ensure everything is right, and it will take time. And you know, how long along this 6 month journey do you go before the patient starts to suffer everything that they've been trying to avoid?
And I think coming to a couple of your points, I think the guidance is almost going to be just as important as the actual legislation, because going through this, and I've been through it a few times, but the guidance is going to have to cover off a multitude of issues. So when we have these checks and balances, so if you have the first opinion clinician, then if you go to a second opinion clinician, is that in the same trust? Is that on the same day? Is that a private clinician? Is that clinician paid? You know, are they allowed to be paid? Because does that create an element of issue? I don't know.
What if they disagree?
Exactly. What happens? Is there a form of appeal, if I can put it that way, to a different MDT? Is it a specific clinic? Do these conversations, or does the terminal event happen in an NHS trust, in a hospice, at home? And also it's about the, like you said, about the clinicians on the first and second opinion. What discipline are they? Because ideally, of course, it would be the disciplines that are covering off the terminal illness, but also you have the psychiatrist element as well to cover off the capacity. So is there any way of circumventing a few weeks in the panel and the judicial panel to get to that capacity, then we get on to, and I know this may be very interesting to some of our listeners, about the indemnifying of these people. Because I know we've discussed it, Rob, in the past, but if it happens in an NHS trust, are they indemnified by NHS resolution? If it happens in a home setting, are those clinicians indemnified by their own MDO cover? Will this lead to new schemes for indemnity? And so there's also just the other elements of, I suppose, other things you need to look at of what if there is a query failed attempt, and if there is something that occurs following from that. So, for example, if someone were to be given the medication that can work as anticipated and lead to a peaceful death, but they have a hypoxic event and survive, what happens in the indemnity in that situation? Is that a product liability position? Is that a clinician position? This throws up so many queries going back to the guidance. And
yeah, no, I was just going to check, because there's a lot of things you've mentioned there. So in terms of, I mean, you're right, in terms of indemnity, I don't think any of us know the answers to all of those questions yet. One of the points that you mentioned just there is the what if it doesn't work? And there is provision in the bill around that to an extent. But I do think, let's take, for example, the awful situation that, as you say, someone, yeah, the medication is administered, but for some reason it doesn't have the effect that it was supposed to have, and they don't die, and they have suffer a, I don't know, as you say, an hypoxic event or something. It wouldn't then be lawful, I don't think, for a doctor to then assist further in ending that person's life. I think that would go beyond, certainly go beyond the bill, and then we're in the grounds of murder. So there does need to be, or will be useful to have, some kind of provision. I know you can't force these things, but personally, I would like to see patients to be encouraged to write an advanced decision ahead of all of this. I mean, it's their wishes are obviously implied by the fact that they've gone through this process in the first place, or their best interests are. But nonetheless, if they are in that situation where it doesn't work, if they had an advanced decision to refuse treatment, which included provision that they understood that that refusal could lead to their death, at least the doctors, the treating teams at that point in ITU, presumably, would know this is not a person who wants to be kept alive at all costs, and they wouldn't do active treatment, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that would be a useful addition to encourage people, at least, to include. What I'd like to see, because I feel like we're being very negative about the bill, and let's not forget that it is that balance, and I think it will work, particularly once Parliament has scrutinised it and tidied up a lot of these challenges. I would like to see it happen quickly. Obviously the bill, if it was going to happen, it needs to happen quickly, but certainly this morning the talk was of it not being coming in for another 4 years. But I mean, the actual process, if it's going to happen, because of that 6 month period of time the patient has, there needs to be some mechanism so that, allowing for those periods of reflection, the first declaration endorsed by the doctor, second, the independent doctor, can be done within a few weeks. And then, and this is the big crucial thing, that judicial panel sits really quickly. And we know the delays that the court system has at the moment. I mean, the Court of Protection, and this wouldn't be the Court of Protection necessarily, but the Court of Protection, as you know, does sit in emergency situations or urgently. But does this panel, you know, and because it would have to be a situation where they are able to sit within a week or 2 weeks or something like that of the declaration coming in. Because if it's months, then the patient may have died by the time the hearing is actually taking place. So let's hope there's some provision for that.
And also, going on from that, I just wondered if you have any thoughts as to whether there should be anything in any guidance or anything put in place for that patient in that period of time. Because, of course, we're talking about potentially long periods of time, which for that patient would be excruciatingly long. But should there be any coping mechanisms for patients, whether it be psychology or something put in place, do you think, for that patient to cope? throughout this period, or do you think that would muddy the waters a bit?
Well, I mean, I don't think it would muddy the waters. I mean, I'd hope that they have that support in place already. There's certainly discussion in the media and in Parliament, in fact, that funding for palliative care hospices, say, needs to be improved. The hospice community is an amazing community. I should say I've got a bit of a declaration of interest here because I'm a trustee of a hospice, but they are incredible organizations and they provide phenomenal support, psychological support, as well as pain relief and comfort for patients, not just at the end of life process necessarily, but I would certainly endorse better support for those services so that patients such as these and others who don't want to go through this process are able to access that when they need. I mean, I suppose that goes to one of the questions you sort of touched on it with the indemnity question, but you know, where will this happen? You know, where do you think if a person goes through the process, they have the declarations, the judges or the panel endorses it, second declaration is endorsed. Is this going to be in their home? Is this going to be in a hospice? Is this going to be a hospital, a private provider, or all of those things?
I think, Rob, there's probably a place for all of them, really. I think, of course, there is going to be the public sector, if I can put it that way, for NHS trusts, so that if somebody does have capacity at the time the declaration is made, but perhaps starts becoming too frail and they are in hospital anyway, then it could happen in hospital. Whether it takes place in a certain part of the hospital is a practical discussion. I think, of course, for the more ambulant person, there is scope for the private sector as well. But of course, then you do have the patients that wouldn't necessarily be able to get to hospital purely for because they can't walk anymore or it's too painful. And actually, this would happen in their home or in a hospice. But of course, there have to be those indemnity provisions there to make sure everyone is safe and is covered and make sure everything is okay. But if things happen outside of a hospital setting, I think, and this takes it into the legal world a bit, what happens from if someone watches it, if a family member watches this happen, you know, because if someone's sat there holding a person's hand with the inevitable terminal event, what happens from a psychiatric or secondary victim claim perspective? Because there are those elements there that could throw up potential issues. And I just throw that out there as a query, because if something were to happen, could there be a secondary victim? Because effectively, you know, the criteria for all COC are covered. So you've got the close ties of love and affection, time and space, claimant must perceive that the incident themselves. But then you throw in the Ronayne criteria, so that a person that puts themselves into a hospital or clinic situation has to have the reasonable fortitude to essentially know that that's going to happen by objective standards. But then you throw in Paul as well.
There's a lot of legal stuff there. Let me just explain to listeners, just in case they're not familiar with all of these things. So secondary victim claims are where there's been, and this is the crucial thing, there's been negligence established to the primary victim, i.e. the person to whom the injury occurred. In this case, we're talking, I'm assuming, about the patient, the person dying. There are occasions where it is reasonably foreseeable to the person who's caused that injury negligently that someone else with close ties of love and affection, as you say, and proximity, might suffer a psychiatric injury, a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And if so, that person who suffered that injury, the psychiatric injury, is known as a secondary victim, and they could be eligible for compensation. Sorry to interrupt you. I just thought that there will be some people who don't necessarily or aren't necessarily a fay with all of this legal terminology. But yeah, you're right. I mean, and they, I suppose there'd have to be a negligent act. So this is none of this. The person dying itself is a negligent act because it's done through the processes and it's all done correctly. I suppose what you're saying is, what if the doctor, one of the doctors, say, got it wrong and didn't go through the process properly, didn't investigate, I don't know, the wife or husband of the dying person saying, have you not spoken to so-and-so who's been coercing my loved one into this, and they don't really want it, and they just ignore that. Is that negligence? It might be. Whether it'd be interesting to know who has the claim. It would have to be the estate, the person themselves who's died, and their estate who brings the claim. But yeah, you're right. That's certainly something to worry about.
but also, I think, because I know that was very technical, that element. And of course, the main focus is on the patient and what is happening. But because this is a very difficult and very sensitive topic for everybody, we also have to look after the clinicians to some point. And I think in any guidance or anything, to make sure that they are also okay is to ensure that they have some form of CPD or training or therapy for afterwards to ensure they can actually cope with this. Because if this turns into their career, for want of a better word, they are going to have to be looked after, aren't they? I mean, what do you think?
No, I completely agree. I mean, I suppose to play, it's not really devil's advocate, but just to expose a different side to this. Many doctors will say, well, I do this all the time. You know, particularly if you work in, say, palliative care or oncology, you will be faced with people dying constantly. And also, these doctors will be making decisions all the time about whether someone has capacity, whether someone is being coerced, whether someone is really making an informed decision about whatever treatment it is they're refusing or not refusing. And they will be exposed to some horrific events. I don't know, someone's a victim of a stabbing or a car crash, or, you know, they're exposed to these things all the time. So they should certainly be offered and have that, the ability to have that therapy. Do they need it especially for this? I mean, yes, I'm sure they do. But I think one of the crucial safeguards we'd need in this bill, and you don't really need it because it's almost axiomatic, but is that you can't force a doctor to take on this role in the same way that you can't force one of the members of that judicial panel, the psychiatrist, the social worker, to take on that role. They would have to voluntarily apply. There may be situations then when the doctor who's approached by a patient to make that declaration doesn't feel comfortable to do it. Perhaps they've got their own spiritual, religious reasons why they don't agree with it, or perhaps they just don't agree, or for other reasons, they just don't want to take on that responsibility. And there definitely needs to be some kind of provision to protect against those people so they're not being vilified for not taking it on, in the same way that there needs to be protection for those people who do take it on against potential abuse they might receive in the media or elsewhere for taking on that responsibility. I mean, interesting to look at what other jurisdictions do. You mentioned Australia, and I think the Victoria example, state of Victoria, seems to work very well in terms of where it happens, where the person dies. It tends, as I understand, it tends to be at home mostly, which would make sense because people would, you would have thought, want to be within the comfort of their own home, around loved ones when this happens. I know it's not always possible because some people's condition is such that they can no longer live at home. They might need specialist care or equipment that they can't get at home, but it does seem to happen there. They also, in Victoria, as I understand it, tend to self-administer completely. So they get given the medication, prescribed the medication, and it gets given to them and they take it themselves. And I think that's where we're going in this country, but there is debate about that, isn't there?
I agree with you. I think at the start of this, I think as far as we go, or as far as the bill goes, is to assist, to give, not to actually administer it. But I assume that it's envisaged that is, whether it be handing the medication to the person or assisting them in putting it towards their mouth or something like that. But I think that's as far as we go. But also what I thought was really interesting about the Victoria element is that there is only one medication that is provided, and it's state provided, and there's no quibbles or qualms about it. So there's no choice or query as to how it affects people. I just thought that was really quite an interesting and bold move. But it does take some of that uncertainty out of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, and they do have a lot of safeguards in Victoria. I know that, but not as many as they are envisaged or proposed in the UK. Certainly England and Wales, because we keep talking about the UK, but it is, appreciate, slightly different in Scotland. But I think there is an argument, and I'll put it no stronger than that, to say the safeguards they have are sufficient. But, well, let's see what the eventual legislation we have in the UK, England and Wales looks like. But they certainly don't have the judicial panel that's envisaged here, and therefore all the steps that need to be taken to reach the end point.
And I think there's always going to be a worry about legislation like this being watered down to move into other areas. And you mentioned as well things such as neurological issues or permanent vegetative state or something like that. Do you think that we have enough safeguards in the current system, so best interests and advanced decisions and things, to cover off those issues? Or do you think there is scope in time for this being watered down, do you think?
It's a really good question. I mean, will it be watered down or will it be expanded? I don't think so, because it's quite stringent as to what the criteria is. There's certainly talk about whether it includes various people with mental health conditions like eating disorders, and because those eating disorders fall into physical conditions as well by nature of the outcome of not eating or not taking enough nutrition, there are arguments that it falls within to that. I don't think it would necessarily, but it might do, because there are people with eating disorders, say, who do have mental capacity, and so would fulfill that criteria, and arguably, possibly, might have 6 months left to live. I think that will be difficult for a doctor to find that's right, but it is a possibility. And looking at the patients in PVS, no is the short answer. I think, well, obviously, by nature, they won't have capacity, so they won't succeed on that eligibility criteria. What I suppose I'm worried about, well, not worried about, but what I find slightly confusing in the system is that there is this legislation being proposed in order to ensure a certain cohort of people don't suffer or don't endure potentially unbearable suffering towards the end of their life. But the law in this country in relation to PVS patients is enables treatment, well, treatment as in artificial nutrition, hydration, to be withdrawn if it's agreed to be in the best interest. And there's a case called REWY, which covers that and says that you don't necessarily need to go to court to do that if everyone is in agreement and there's second opinions and the like. But this is the challenge. But having withdrawn artificial nutrition and hydration to that patient to enable them to die, it's not then lawful to help them die. So they might, I appreciate they'll be given all kinds of palliative care support, but they might be starving to death. Well, they will be starving to death, but they might be suffering while they're doing that, at least to an extent, for those, I don't know, 1 week, 2 week, could be longer. So there is a bit of a gap in the law there. If this bill gets through Parliament, for a cohort of people who are advocating on behalf of people in PVS states to say, well, what about my loved one? But at the moment, I don't think, from the way this bill is being drafted, I don't think the slippery slope would enable those to fall within it. When it comes in some form or another, let's hope that it is streamlined and there ultimately to serve its purpose, which is to help the patients themselves. We're calling them patients. They're not actually patients. These are the people themselves. And crucially, the clinicians who will take on this big responsibility of overseeing all of this process and ensuring the declarations are scrutinized and are correct. And yes, they can be challenged, but ultimately can be signed off. So thank you for listening to today's podcast. We look forward to talking with you in future. Please don't forget to subscribe and follow this podcast on your usual podcast platforms. Do comment, and if you've got any suggestions or requests for further topics, please let us know. Look forward to speaking to you soon.